Welcome to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturday.
Hi there, this is Anna David. You're listening to After Party Pod. Now, this is crazy. This is episode 100. We made it. Centennial. Faithful listeners know this started off as a weekly podcast, and then its producer, host, writer, and whatever else she is, person with a cold today, got overwhelmed, and it became bi-weekly. And I love that you guys stuck with it and stuck with me. And yet, we crept along till 100. What's pretty amazing is this is somewhat accidental that number 100 is such a special show. I kind of knew I was counting and, sorry, I just got really close to the mic. I hope that wasn't totally annoying. But my guest today is Josie. Now, if you are into recovery or the players in recovery, you know the name Josie. In fact, probably a year ago, a listener emailed me and said, you've got to get this guy on your show. And I said, you know, he's in Canada. I don't do Skype. I'm a sound snob, even though all I do is have sound issues. And I was lucky enough to connect with Joe on the Twitter, as you kids call it. None of you do, but let's just pretend you do. And he was willing to come to LA. I mean, he was already kind of going to be in LA. And not only was I able to interview him, but then it happened to be the same day my mother was visiting. And so mom had to sit there and listen / got to. And we even got her to say something on sort of. She said something and then Joe was able to summarize it so you could hear it. And he's my most intellectual guest, and my mother is a former English professor, so it was kind of cool, you know, that she could see that I know how to have smart conversations, right? But anyway, Josie is 4 decades sober, and he runs, I think it's safe to say, a movement called Rebellion Dogs. If you're familiar with the literature, there's a line, rebellion dogs are every step. So it's a very clever turning a verb into a noun. I think that's what I mean. I know, dog, whatever. Anyway, he is the author of the very popular book, Beyond Belief, Agnostic Musings for 12-Step Life. And the reason agnostic is in his title of his book is that is what his mission in life. I don't know if that's overstating. He is very interested in spreading awareness about how it's possible to be an agnostic in 12-step. He is not somebody who has any issues with the program. He loves the program, but he came to see that this is something that should be talked about, and he's right. And many, many people are incredibly appreciative of the work that he does. He goes around the world speaking about this, and he is a fantastically fascinating guy. So what else do I want to tell you about him? You can check out everything he does at rebelliondogspublishing.com. And he's awesome. So go get his book. You can get that on his website. And he's got a radio show. Oh, sorry. He's got a whole bunch of other things. He's got something called Rebellious Radio. He is also probably the greatest living expert on 12-step history. Knows stuff that blew me away. I don't know much at all, but never said I did. But anyway, that is who your guest is today. What else do I want to tell you? You can find more information about After Party Pod. You can find us on Twitter. When I say us, I mean After Party Magazine, which is what After Party Pod is a part of. After Party Magazine posts 12 stories a day about addiction and recovery. Like I said, we're on Twitter at After Party site. We are on Facebook, the After Party group. But if you're going to the URL, it's facebook.com/afterpartychat, because I don't know if you've ever tried to change a name on Facebook. It ain't easy. And them. Oh, and if you want a copy of our free, of our ebook, How I Got Sober, 10 Alcoholics and Addicts Share Their Stories, it is available on Amazon, but I can send you a free copy, or at least someone I work with can. All you got to do is send an email to info@theafterpartygroup.com and we will get that out to you. And the other main thing that I want to tell you is terribly exciting to me, which is that I'm launching a new podcast. It's all I'm going to tell you right now, but it is very much in the works. I'm very passionate about it, and I can't say much more except that it's coming soon. And I cannot tell you how much I would appreciate it if you guys, moved over there too. It's going to be weekly. It's going to be good. If you're interested in this, it's expanding a little bit on this. I mean, a lot on this, and I will be telling you more in future weeks. What else did I want to talk about? I got a great email from a listener from somebody named Paul who loves the podcast. He does. He talked specifically about the episodes with John Heffron, Jeff Rhoda, Bob Marier, Cindy Caponera, and really loves this podcast. He found it because he was listening to Stephanie Miller's SMS podcast. I had to admit to him, I didn't know who that was. And she has something called the After Party Videocast. And some of my podcast guests have been on that. So that's from Paul. Love your emails. You can email me, Anna@theafterpartygroup.com. Anyway, this is Josie.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God. I think my copy has like bloodstains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
Okay, Joe.
Yes.
I'm so excited you're here. This has been a tumultuous
beginning. I'm so excited
beginning.
I'm here, yes.
But our beginning, I was just telling you as we were getting hot tea that was actually cold.
Yeah.
That I first heard of you because a listener emailed me, I want to say a year ago.
Yeah.
Said, you have to have Josie on your podcast. He's in Canada. And I said, oh, that's great. I, you know, looked you up. I found on the info. And I was like, I don't do Skype because I'm a sound snob, which is ironic because my sound always gets screwed up. and this is what I stopped. I got distracted by the cold tea, but I assigned my writer, Tracy, a story on you, which she just never got started on.
Right.
Then we met on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny how that works. I mean, let's face it. This continent is a big landmass, but the recovery community is a small town. Mm-hmm. You know, and especially podcasting, you know, a smaller town. So, mm-hmm. You know, we've got crossover listeners, of course, you know. And
hey, guys. Yeah. Are you excited we're together?
Yeah, I bet they are.
So what happened, and then at Unite to Face Addiction in D.C.,
yeah, mm-hmm.
I remember standing near bleachers, kind of, and somebody goes, oh, look, Josie's dancing over there. And I go, oh, Josie, I wanted to meet him. But then that was the extent of it. You were dancing on bleachers. Does this ring a bell?
I do that, sure. Yeah, I'm known to do that.
And then I think you tweeted at me something about the show, and I was like, you listen to the show. This is so exciting.
Yeah.
And that's how it's all started.
Yeah. The problem is there's more and more great shows.
Mm-hmm.
Used to be there were a couple, and most of them were pretty bad. I mean, they were kind of old-fashioned sounding.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were some hip ones and some new ones.
About recovery, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Really?
Yeah, for sure.
I'm so ignorant about mm-hmm. what else is out there.
Yeah, well, since right now, you know...
I'd love those guys.
Yeah, exactly. They're great, right?
Mm-hmm. And, but that's the only one I really know, besides you.
Yeah, well, there's more. I mean, there's some that have been around forever, right? I mean, here in California, right, there's Recovery 101. It's kind of like three people. It's like coffee shop talk after AA or... NA meeting. It's just
the meeting after the meeting.
Yeah, exactly. And they've had a show forever.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah.
I know nothing.
Yeah. And then there's like real, you know, big book thumper type of, you know, kneeling at the altar of all.
And they
things.
Have shows?
12 steps.
These people?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, who wouldn't take advantage of this medium? I mean, if you're into anonymity, it's anonymous, right? You know, it's creative. Your reach is worldwide, right? You know, if people can find you, it doesn't matter where you broadcast from.
Well, in terms of anonymity, it's not anonymous for me or my guests.
Yeah.
You're the first one who's going to come on without a last name. I don't even know your last name.
Yeah.
So the anonymity thing, it's the opposite.
Yeah.
Really, for this show.
Yeah. I am so like cutting edge on some things, but old school in other things.
Yeah.
And, you know, that anonymity thing. I mean, why not? The, you know, the medium isn't the message. The message is the message, right? So...
But what about being open about what's in the literature and talking specifically about it, but still, it isn't that, you know, disobeying the 11th tradition as much as not saying your last name?
How so?
Well, I mean, I have a thing where I won't talk specifically about the literature because...
Oh, on your show. Okay.
In general.
Right. Okay.
I mean,
yeah.
In writing.
Right.
I mean,
okay.
Yeah. People. Yes, absolutely. But I think it's more protectiveness because I think that it, you know, just like eavesdropping on a conversation, the people always sound like idiots, even if it's like Einstein and Shakespeare. They sound stupid because you're not a part of the conversation. To me, letting anybody who doesn't understand this in on what some of the literature says and what they'll never understand it. And so it gives them an opportunity to judge, which they're already doing so much anyway.
But podcasts aren't like radio where people just turn a station on and leave it there and they would stumble across your show and listen to it anyway because they're not going to bother changing the channel.
Right, true.
You know, they want to hear your show. They come, they're a particular demographic. I wish I knew more about the demographic of my audience, but I treat them to their fair share of anonymity too, right? But, you know, like it's not like strangers to the recovery community are listening to your show or my show for, you know, shits and giggles.
I will say that this woman on Facebook, who I got to know, not in recovery at all, doesn't know anything about recovery, is like, huge fan of your podcast. She was a fan of somebody that I had on the podcast, listens all the time. I'm like, why are you
well,
interested?
That'll happen for sure.
Are you interested?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Yeah. And then again, you get this crossover audience thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What, let's tell listeners about your show.
Okay. My show is called Rebellion Dogs Radio, and the tagline is less dogma, more bite, because I'm all about, you know, pushing forward. There's a real resistance to change in any society, book-based societies especially. They usually break off into two camps. There's the preserving the integrity of the message camp, and then there's the expanding or widening the gateway camp. Mm-hmm. And they both see the others as chaotic and frightening, right? You know, and I'm thinking in terms of the preserving the integrity of the message camp, that they're more likely to, treat the steps as sacred, and the expanding the message to more people, they're more treating it as a tool,
mm-hmm.
right? Take what you like, leave the rest, right? So...
What's interesting about that is that I see you as such an exception to this, truly, but the vitriol of the people who have an issue with the spirituality or religiousness mm-hmm. of the program mm-hmm. Compared to, and this is just anecdotal, within 12-step, people are like, people got an issue with that. They're, you know, revolting or they're doing whatever. Let them do it.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. That, people who reject sort of a traditional theistic kind of spirituality are still seen maybe as intellectual holdouts. Maybe they're, sort of trying to intellectualize a process that is quote unquote spiritual,
right.
Whatever that means.
Right.
I mean, what does intellectualizing it mean? What does, you know, spiritual mean? I mean, it's like yellow. You and I could talk about what yellow, my experience of yellow and your experience of yellow. We would never know if we're seeing the same shape.
I could
shape.
Be seeing red and
yeah,
you
yeah.
call that yellow.
Yeah, we would never
I
know.
I call it yellow.
And that's the problem with these words, right? Agnostic, atheist, spiritual. They're almost meaningless because while they mean something to everybody...
They mean different things.
Yeah, everyone's nodding, but we don't have a consensus on exactly what that explanation of a process is.
Do you think there are other words like that in the English language?
Let's see. I think, people, get mixed up.
Yeah, that they mean different things to different people. I mean, I guess colors work.
Yeah, colors for sure. Like, you know, I am from the music business, so indie, you know, for some people that's a sound. It's a, for other people it's a management style, and other people it's a band that's not good enough to be signed by a label, right? You know, and so you say an indie band, and you don't know what message you're conveying, because they're going to hear it based on their understanding of the word indie.
Right. That's interesting. I was just thinking, my mom and I went to the last bookstore today, and I saw Lena Dunham's book. Huge Lena Dunham fan, under literary nonfiction.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, that's the definition of literary nonfiction? You know, if that wasn't Lena Dunham, that'd be considered chick lit. That's crazy. But, it, you know, sort of an example of that.
Yeah, well, it's just, you know, I think someone once said, and I really buy into this, that experience trumps explanation. If you and I talk about our experience of addiction and our experience of recovery, we're going to nod and agree with each other. But right. Then we try to explain it. I'm an alcoholic because I came from a dysfunctional home, or I'm an alcoholic because of whatever, or I recovered because I worked the 12 steps, or we associate some sort of agency to what our experience was, and we might not be agreeing anymore.
Right.
But we were 100% connecting when right. We were just talking about the experience without the explanation. It's the explanation where people, you know, sort of divide into camps.
That's really interesting. What, going back to this idea that some of the people who, well, I guess some of the people who are anti 12 steps are very angry. It reminds me a little bit of like sort of San Francisco versus LA,
mm-hmm.
or New York versus LA, where in LA we're like, oh yeah, love San Francisco, love New York. And then in those cities, they're like, ah, oh, those LA people, and they're very angry.
Yeah, for sure. And it's like either, you know, you're pro New York or not, right? Same thing, right? And even Alcoholics Anonymous has that issue, right? That GSO happens to be in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So everywhere else is, you know, don't tell me how to run my home group, mm-hmm. right? You know, I don't want you a liberal, you know, intellectuals ruining my 12-step program or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of sort of mistrust just because of that sort of New York connection, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then again, the culture in San Francisco is very different than it is in LA. Things that are important to people are different. Montreal, Toronto has the same issue. Like, well, Toronto is kind of, you're either Toronto, center of the universe, or anti-Toronto.
Right.
You know, it's kind of that way. It's unnecessary. It's yeah. unhelpful, but it's human nature.
And your story, you got into 12-step as a teenager, right?
Yeah. You shake any family tree and a drunk or two are going to fall out mm-hmm. of it, right? You know, you just, nobody avoids that. And in my case, I wasn't, not only was I not the first alcoholic to don our family tartan. Mm-hmm. There's a clue about my last name. That's as far as we go.
There's no C in that.
No, but class. Family tartan. Scottish.
What is it? Oh, he told you?
He's a Scot.
I mean, you know the last name?
There are just so many clans.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm part Icelandic, part Scottish. So there's my anonymity blown.
I mean, it's all over for you. Downhill from here.
Yeah. So I wasn't the first member of my family to get sober. And in the 70s, our family seemed to have a notorious, what I call, two-step habit.
Mm-hmm.
They would, you know, come to understand that they were powerless over alcohol. And look, so is she, and so is he, and you better do these 20 questions, because I think you're going to mm-hmm. you're gonna be a winner on here.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this, you know, and most people sort of buy the book. That's not how you do it. You work step one, and you go all the way through, and then you work step 12 after the other 11. But we kind of had a sort of codependent kind of finger-pointing recovery.
Mm-hmm.
And in a weird way, I don't recommend it, but it worked. And so I was dragged to my first meeting after being found face up in my own vomit. You know, in the hospital, my mom didn't even know where I was, found me the next day and, you know, finger pointing and, you know, if you're not a real alcoholic, why are you afraid? Just go to one meeting and all right, already, I'll go, right?
How old were you?
14 when I went to my first meeting. And I wasn't ready. I mean, I really had a reasonable expectation that I could manage this. I could be a social drinker. I could have all of the benefits of, you know, the avoidance and the ecstasy of drugs and alcohol without the consequences. I consider myself a heavy social drinker because mm-hmm. that was cool, with bad luck. Mm-hmm. That was true, but not an alcoholic because that seems so clinical.
Right.
And the other thing that was unattractive to me was sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
Because it sounded to me like a punishment mm-hmm. for admitting I was an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I got it. They were promoting the idea of total abstinence. And man, I'm too young and yada, yada. And somehow there was something more romantic about dying a tragic alcoholic death than living sober for another, you know, X number of years. Like all those New Year's Eves, watching it on television. I didn't know what sobriety really was. But, you know, I just had this very strong, visceral feeling about it, that it was unattractive. So I would not have got sober, I don't think, to save my own life. Because my heroes all died that way, I would too. Like, I mean, an alcoholic death is not a romantic thing at all. But I had this fantasy, this delusion about it. But then I was told that my cousin wanted to get sober.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't exactly true. But somehow that was a life worth saving. She, you know, I was going to bring her to meetings, be a good power of example, get her up on her way. And then I don't know what my plan was. I was going to sneak out the door, die a tragic alcoholic death. But there would be a national holiday because I got her sober and she got someone sober and they got someone sober.
Right.
I just...
Grandiose.
Yeah, totally, totally grandiose. So I was a case of... I wasn't planning on staying. I learned how to hide out in plain view. And as a teenage addict or alcoholic, you are totally inauthentic. You walk into a liquor store, you look like you're old enough to buy whiskey. You walk into a bar, you have to act like you own the place, right? You're buying drugs from complete strangers. You have to act tougher than you are
mm-hmm.
and like you know more than you do. So, you know, going to AA meetings and saying, I'm Joe and I'm an alcoholic, wasn't any confession.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was just how not to draw attention to myself.
Just another sort of costume or whatever.
Yeah, totally, right? And it was good for my cousin, and she was going to get sober, and it was going to be great. And so I got to experience sobriety, kind of test drive it, because I was only doing it for her. And eventually I found out that sobriety wasn't a punishment for being an alcoholic. It was a blank canvas. Some people were living lives I didn't want,
right.
But other people were living lives that I could, you know, that they were kind of powers of example to me. They were still cool in my books.
And so when you said, you know, I'm Joe and I'm an alcoholic, did you feel like you were lying or you were just like, eh, whatever?
I could have passed a polygraph test. Right. Every time I said I would quit drinking for the rest of my life, you know, if I was telling a parent, a principal, a girlfriend, you know, law enforcement, I would, you know, if you had wired me up to a lie detector, it would say this kid is absolutely sincere. So I believed what I was saying,
mm-hmm.
but I was kind of out of my mind.
And did you stay sober from 14?
No. I was brought to my first meeting when I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
And then by the time I was 16, you know, I heard about my cousin wanting
to find
recovery. And so I started on a, you know, sort of power of example path instead of a knowing what the hell I'm talking about path.
So, yes, you waited until, you know, a long time, till you were 16 years old.
Yeah, yeah, two more years, right? yeah, that's right.
I know one person who got sober at 16 and stayed sober. I know two.
Yeah.
Actually, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, I knew people who died of alcoholism and drug addiction, you know, in my running mates, in my circle, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we went to funerals. It's not like you're too young to be an addict or alcoholic. But there are others. You know, in our family, you know, we probably picked a few out of the drinking herd and said, you got to get sober, you got to yada, yada, yada. That, you know, who knows, maybe they were sowing their wild oats. But for me, how do I know I'm an alcoholic? Because of my relationship with pecan pie. Because of my relationship with driving. You know, like if I'm driving to Florida from Toronto, I want to do it all at once. Mm. I want it to be intense. I want it to be painful. I want it to be like full throttle, right? I want to get there in 24 hours, right? Just coffee it up, you know, speeding tickets, whatever. You know, maybe I'm not quite that chaotic in my life. But, I mean, this trip to L.A. had a little bit of chaos as I was
talking. Well, aside from the chaos I caused you.
Well, tell me. I mean, it's not like I came from Toronto to L.A. just to do this show, although it's a very special thing. I was coming to Arizona.
Yes. You're the lead speaker.
No, not the lead speaker. I'm one of many presenters at something called the Symposium on AA History, and I'm doing an hour on the history of unbelievers, which was the first word that our literature gave, you know, non-theists.
It's not in there anymore, is it?
Only where Bill Wilson is quoted.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, now they kind of use agnostic atheist or humanist. You'll notice that the literature that was written in 1939 and has been, you know, made sacred so they can't adjust it, like, you know, it sounds kind of old-fashioned. But if you read like Marijuana Anonymous literature, like that was written in the 90s, mm-hmm. and it's contemporary language. If you read Online Gamers Anonymous 2001, it talks about we atheists and agnostics not as a second-rate means of sobriety, you poor suckers, you can't have this white light experience, but just as a regular everyday thing. And so it's only the original literature that really is sort of lost in reification. It's kind of, you know, because, I mean, let's face it, that book.
Mm-hmm. Here we go.
Yeah. It took 40 or 100 people to come to a consensus on writing it.
Okay.
Right? And because AA is really owned by its members, AA is its members, and I can tell you why I feel that way if you like, but it's not a program.
Yeah, I've heard you say that.
Yeah, it's a fellowship.
Yeah.
Right? And you can't find any defense for AA as a program in our preamble, in our traditions.
Well, and speaking of words having, you know, being misused, I heard you say this on, maybe it was Rebellion Dogs.
Mm-hmm.
You work a program.
I do.
But, no, not you.
Okay.
One works a program, yeah. But people go, I'm in the program. It's like, that actually doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't make sense, right? What do you mean by that, right? Like, and again, it means something to people and other people not, how long you've been in the program, right? But, it, you know, we're not in a program. And the problem with that is it becomes, the program becomes sacred. That becomes what AA is. And if people want to change God as we understand him to God of our understanding to make it gender neutral, people get outraged about that. Or if they, you know, want to change it to, you know, a power of example or, you know, whatever, right? Some secular version of, you know, higher power or power greater than ourselves. People get offended. They get threatened. They think you're destroying what AA is. But AA isn't the program.
Mm-hmm.
We have a suggested program, and I will defend that program. It's a great program. I recommend it, but I'm not caught up on the language. I mean, that book is printed in 78 different languages, maybe more. I don't know. You know, surely we can have a secular language.
And so what is your actual belief about what is out there besides
I us? Believe that there is no God. And when I say that, I'm not saying that I know there isn't. I'm saying I just have no experience of that. You know, maybe I'm wrong, right? Mm-hmm. If you are a true skeptic, right, you know, I like what Bertrand Russell said, right? You know, mm-hmm. the true free thinker doesn't bow to the masses and doesn't bow to their own impulses. But they, if they bow to anything, it's to the evidence.
Right.
And sometimes there's new evidence based on new information that you can change your mind. And a true skeptic is like a child, right? Always willing to see, broaden their world by seeing it a different way, right? So in 40 years, I've never had a, you know, religious experience in AA. But there was a time where I thought believing and belonging were synonymous. And that concerned me. And now I don't. I definitely don't.
Do you see religious and spiritual as synonymous?
Well, I see belief in a personal God as a religious belief. You know, I mean, there are all the Abrahamic faiths have a, you know, sort of single deity kind of thing, right? I think that's it. But, you know, like if someone has a Star Wars kind of idea, the Force or something like that, I mean, that might not be religious. But most people, when they say, you know, we're spiritual, not religious, means we don't go to church on Sunday. But, you know, some of the tenets are what I would call religious tenets. And, you know, I would think that the belief in a personal God is a religious tenet. And I'm not saying that is a bad thing. If you believe in one and I don't, you know, that's just... You know, you're left-handed, I'm right-handed. It's just right. How we are, right? You know, it's not a higher level of awareness or, you know, doing more work. It's just, you know, I think it's more important to be authentic about it than it is to conform to it or to rebel against it.
Yeah. Yeah. Despite the name of your company.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know where that line comes from? Yeah,
rebellion dogs are every step.
At first.
Oh, is that what it says at first?
Yeah.
I don't remember that part, but it's in the 12 and 12, right?
Yes.
But it's funny because it makes no sense. It makes your name get stuck in my head. Like the fact that I know that's from our literature, because mm-hmm. I just love the way you played with the dogs and
I love words.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was in a AA band. And we used to play like conferences and little, you know, open mic nights and things like that. And the real genius of the band, her name was Kathy, and she wrote a song called Rebellion Dogs. And it was about actual dogs that were always barking outside her window that she could never rest. She could never find peace because wherever she went, right, you know, they were lurking around the corner. It was a beautiful metaphor,
right.
A beautiful song, and a great play on words. And, you know, I was playing that song in the 80s, right? And that has always stayed with me. I just liked it. And
like every great artist you stole.
Oh, I researched. Yeah. You know, if you take from one, that is a copyright infringement.
Right.
You take from 100, that's research, that's academia.
Right. What, and are you still in touch? Does she know that you have a
book? Oh, totally. Yeah. She's flattered.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It lives on.
Yeah, totally. Exactly.
I remember when I got sober hearing a woman share that her sponsor was in a band called, this is amazing, Dr. Bob's Nightmare.
Oh, wow.
What an amazing band name is that?
Yeah,
and
that
I just thought,
great.
That is the coolest chick I've never met.
Yeah.
That is so cool.
Yeah, I love those great play on words. There's a women's secular meeting called She Agnostics.
Yeah, that's cute.
Great play on We Agnostics.
Yeah.
Right, you know? Yeah, but yeah, that Dr. Bob's Nightmare, because no one outside the club, if you're not in the book club, you have no idea what it just it sounds like a punk band or something, right?
Yeah.
But anyone in the club, you know, immediate recognition of, okay, we know what those people are about.
And in terms of, okay, I'm just going to delve a tiny bit into my, you know, sort of spiritual belief or experience. You know, never thought about it much, never had a bad idea about it. And then my experience was that trying to quit drugs and drinking and later smoking, I couldn't do it. I tried every sort of conceivable idea, and then the desire went away.
Right.
Was that your experience?
With eventually not...
Yeah. Like, do you think about using and do you have craving? You know what I mean? Did it go away?
Yeah. No, I didn't have cravings. But, I mean, the flaw in my recovery system was because I was so inauthentic.
Right.
You know, I didn't have much of a foundation. I was, you know, sort of, I knew all the right words. I performed how it works when I read it, right? You know, and I sounded like I wrote it myself, that I believed it, right? And so I was one of these alcoholics that while my sobriety date never changed, you know, I had problems with relationships. I had problems with excesses of different kinds. I say sometimes in meetings that I don't have any hobbies. I started jogging because, you know, I needed to do something with all of this bent up energy when I got sober. I started marathon running. I started playing guitar and I became a recording artist, right? I can't seem to do things just, you know, for fun.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you hear a lot of people talking about, you know, sort of addictions or obsessive compulsive behaviors, and you arrest one and then it manifests itself in, you know, workaholism. And not that I'm saying working in an excessive amount is a disease. Right. I'm not crazy about the disease model. It's a good metaphor.
Yeah.
I get it as a metaphor, but I'm not really, you know, workaholism is kind of we know what it means when we say it, right? And yeah, so, you know, my emotional bottom was probably 25 years into recovery. Just
did you wait that long to tell people about your sort of spiritual?
Kind of. I had a way of what I thought was being true to myself that allowed them to think whatever they wanted. I would say things like spiritual awakening, I don't know, but root awakenings, let's talk. And I would give an example of stories I had where I learned a lesson, and of the educational variety, mm-hmm. you know. And I would say, how about, can we have a God as we don't understand him? Right?
So you were kind of getting laughs.
Yeah, exactly. So I knew how to sort of, without, you know, being, you know, like too inauthentic for me, and I mean, how too authentic is it for someone who is a phony? And I was a phony, right? But I really felt like other people were having an experience that I didn't have. And there was a breakthrough because of the internet. I found a community of non-believers in recovery. You know, I thought they were rare. I thought I was an oddball. And I, you know, started to really sort of rewrite my narrative and speak up for, you know, just how I saw things, not as an evolution of an old way of doing things, but just something more authentic for me. I got to a point in my life, like I had, you know, two divorces. I've had two children from two different moms. I've left, you know, sort of wreckage of heartache and all that sort of thing, and always a victim of a series of misunderstandings and bad breaks. And, you know, you got to understand that I'm the victim here. And, you know, just like, you know, there was a lot of mess, bankruptcies, mm-hmm. right? So you look at this and you go, that's not a conference speaker. Mm-mm. That's not someone they're going to have at the World Conference if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it. No, I don't want that. that doesn't seem like a success story. So, you know, and that's embarrassing in a way. You know, there were times where I was despondent about 12-step recovery because I had naive notions that, you know, you do all these things and all your character defects will go away. And why didn't they? I must have done something wrong. Back to the drawing board, right? And I don't see it that way anymore. I see it as a, you know, kind of a, you know, every characteristic has a healthy side to it and an unhealthy side to it. You know, what made me such a great liar is my creativity, right? And so, you know, I don't want to dampen the creativity. I need a recovery that has order, but not with a lack of spontaneity, because pure order becomes rigid, and then it becomes fascist. I can get to the point where my way or the highway, everyone else is wrong, and you know that's no way to live. And spontaneity can go to chaos, mm-hmm. where I lived a lot in chaos, and I bounce from chaos to rigidness, chaos mm-hmm. to rigidness, this binge, purge, binge, purge. And so when I was in this phase, and then even from chaos, you can go to nihilism. What's the point?
Right.
We're all going to die. You know, who cares, right? That's not a healthy place to be. And so, you know, I started to say, what do I really believe? And take a chance. I would go to meetings and say what was true for me, not knowing whether I would be allowed to stay, mm-hmm. and not knowing whether I'd be well received. And I was by some and not by others, right? You know, it's going to offend some, it's going to bother some, it's going to disturb some, it's, you know, and for most people, they're just waiting for their turn to talk.
Exactly. Oh, is Joe talking? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's my turn.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it was a big deal in my head to finding this authenticity, sort of renewed my recovery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just, you know, and it was at a time where in the internet, I was finding like a lot of other people were feeling the same way. And if you look at Pew Research studies and everything else, I mean, it's just a natural phenomenon going on in North America anyway.
And, so if that was 25 years in?
Yeah.
How long are you so far?
40.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I'm, I planned my speech for my 20-year medallion probably at 9 months of sobriety. I thought, you know, I'll be 36. I'm going to be like vice president of AA, you know.
Right.
I'm going to be like, you know, and I wasn't even going to meetings at 20 years sobriety. I felt like a phony. I didn't want to be, oh, here's Joe, he's 20 years sober, yada, yada, yada. I was not right in my world. I could see that, and I didn't know how to find a way out, and I just stayed away a lot, right? Mm-hmm. I still have friends, you know, you get long-term friends in AA.
Yeah.
And I read a book by a guy who is an industrialist, and he said he doesn't expect to gain any new friends in life because he said it takes 30 years to solidify a friendship.
Wow. My mom, who's here in the audience.
Hi, Anna's mom.
Studio audience. Is here because she's visiting a friend of 60 years?
I'm 74 years old, and I've known this woman since nursery school.
70 years.
Wow.
So 40 years ago, it became a real friendship, according to that definition.
Yeah. And anyhow, this is what this guy says, right? When a friend dies, it's not like you can replace them, right? Because you're not going to live long enough to. But this this was one guy.
It's pretty dark.
Yeah, for sure. But anyway, we're way off track of something.
I know, but that was so interesting. What we were on, you're 40 years of sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
And so do you, and you go to meetings now?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. You know, I find more and more I'm drawn to sort of the online presence, Facebook groups and, podcasts. Yeah, in the rooms. Yeah, for sure. Like, I really, you know, like that stuff, right? And, you know, so as I'm adding more podcasts and that sort of thing, I'm probably getting to less face-to-face meetings. But, you know, again, I'm not a dogma kind of guy. Like, I don't believe that, you know, if I stop going to meetings, I'm going to get very sick and die.
Right.
I mean, some relapses start from not going to meetings anymore, but so do glorious life choices, right? You know, lots of people, you know, like, you just look at AA. When I got here, we were under 1 million. We got to 2 million in 91, and it's kind of plateaued out, right? It doesn't mean AA is less successful. It just means that, you know, the average sobriety went in 1976 was 2 years. Like, it was total chaos everywhere, right? You know, like, it was a lot of very manic people, very depressed people, very, like, you know, wow, right? And now the average is 10 years, right? And people 10 years sober, I mean, they're not, you know, usually worried about paying the rent and,
right,
you know, all of the chaos of, you know, early sobriety.
How do they get these numbers in that they don't, you know, There are no, you know, surveys outside meetings. And
yeah, they do a couple of things. One is a triennial survey that they just hire Columbia University. And I'm not quite sure how they do it. But if you trust polls and that sort of thing, you know, there you go, right?
Right.
Yeah. And but, you know, it gives you an idea. And if you look at these surveys, like right now it says 38% of members are female, and the average member is 50 years old, and the average sobriety is 10 years, and, you know, 6 out of 10 come from the treatment world. And
God, I didn't know any of this.
Yeah, go to 2.5 meetings a week. And that seems true to me. I mean, that's sort of my sort of sense of, none of those go, oh, that can't be true.
Well, outside, you know, when people go, oh, he has a 5% success rate and all that sort of misconception out there.
Yeah, yeah. There I play both sides of the fence pretty well, because I am critical of Alcoholics Anonymous or the whole 12-step culture, because I think we can do more and we can improve. And I think that being afraid of change is, I mean, there is an alternative change. Unfortunately, it's extinction, right? We need to evolve. So I'm kind of critical on that. But when someone comes and attacks AA from like an intellectual point of view or something, I can see that they lack an understanding, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like I have a new restaurant and I'm writing a book about how awful McDonald's is. Of course, you're going to pick on the biggest out there, right? You
right.
know, it's an easy target.
Yeah.
Because it will never defend itself.
Exactly.
Right? You know, it's been called religious, but it was never there to defend that, you know, so is it, isn't it? I don't know. You know, from my point of view, again, it's a fellowship where nothing is asked of you, right? You are a member if you say you're a member.
Right.
You know, you can do whatever. You don't even have to stay sober to be a member.
Just a desire.
Yeah. Yeah, so people who say it's not successful, I say, you know, how do you base that, right? They go, well, this many people came to AA meetings, and, you know, only this number of them were there after 3 months. Well, when you build a fitness gym, right?
Right.
Everyone joins.
Right.
Does everyone go?
Right.
Right? Like diets. Do diets not work because, you know, people, you know, binge again,
right.
You know, so, you know, how do you really measure effectiveness?
Yeah.
You know, we all have this anecdotal, you know, I, you know, owe my sobriety to XYZ or whatever it is. Right. And, you know, they say, yeah, anyone who does that, it'll always work, yada, yada, yada. But, you know, so I don't know. I know that the medical community, they are like, we kind of AA anyway, not the organization, but the fellowship kind of absconded with the word sobriety.
Uh-huh.
'Cause you can be sober after one beer and going through a breathalyzer test.
Right.
But you can't in an AA meeting.
Right.
Right. We've redefined sober as, you know, like total abstinence. Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, like a lot of people will look at people who've been exposed to AA and say, has their quality of life improved? And if it has, that's a success rate. And the other thing is they talk about the people who leave AA. Well, maybe those are the greatest successes of all. They got what they needed. They're not meeting dependent.
Yeah.
Right? They carried on with their lives. How do we know what became of those people? You can't call them all died drunk.
Right, yeah, right.
You know, so, you know, they're trying to measure something, and they have myths about what AA is and how to measure its sobriety. And so I will, you know, I will mock them when, you know, Lance Dodis or any of these people
Gabrielle Glazer, she's the biggest.
Yeah, totally, exactly. And you've taken some heat from that, right? Like the AA bashers, right?
Yeah.
They're this whole diatribe.
And yeah. Again,
playing with the word.
tribe.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, like it. and they should die. That's what you're really saying. I know you're not saying that. Well, what I do, and it's not just because it's, you know, very traffic friendly, but it doesn't hurt, is I have a writer who kind of became disenchanted.
Mm-hmm.
And she's an amazing writer.
Yeah.
And I let her do piece after piece about it.
Yeah.
About what's wrong with AA.
Yeah.
And you know, Buddhist alternatives to AA, yeah. Smart recovery, and yeah. People go, you know, and so actually I think those people like us
yeah.
more than they hate us.
Right.
And if anything,
at least there's a voice.
Yeah. I mean, I think yeah. if anything, we're perceived as this anti-AA site when like the truth is 99% of us like feel like we owe our lives to it.
Yeah.
But I never wanted to ever put it out there that people had to do it the way I did it.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, it's all based on beliefs. Like, to believe that alcoholism is a disease that is you can't be cured from. We don't know that, but I believe that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I see, you know, evidence in my life where, you know, other obsessive compulsive behavior.
Talking about that drive to Florida.
Yeah, exactly. That kind of thing. I wrote a song called Toronto to Miami, and it was just about, you know, doing that drive, getting to South Beach and wanting to be there tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. What, in terms of your knowledge about AA history, like you are, and I say this non-pejoratively, total AA history geek.
Yeah, I'm going to this history lovers thing, and I call it spring break for geeks, right? Like, who wants to be there, right? You know, I do. Apparently, I totally,
yeah. Yeah.
I want to be there. Because I think it's, Ernie Kurtz, you know, was the first person who sort of wrote about AA academically. And I just loved how he could criticize without condemning.
Right.
Like he could see the strengths and the weaknesses, right? And Joseph Conrad or Joseph Campbell.
Yeah.
Conrad, that's a whole different
thing. I have gotten them mixed up.
Yeah, it's easy. You know, he talks about myths and faith. Respectfully, you know, in a way that it doesn't matter if it's true or not, because, you know, that's just what he's an anthropologist. He's interested in its relationship to people and the community and the sociology of it. And it's fascinating to them. So I have a fascination for AA as a society. And I think the history of AA isn't something that happened in the 1930s and 40s. It's happening right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're going through transitions that, you know, will make or break if there's a 100th anniversary, because that's not a sure thing.
We just ran a story this week on a group in Canada
mm-hmm.
that's suing AA because they won't include them. Are you part of this whole thing?
It's not a lawsuit. I'm not part of it, but I'm aware of it. I'm familiar with it. There is something in Ontario called the Human Rights Commission, and they have a tribunal where it is against the law. It's the law that you can't discriminate against people based on gender, creed, sexual orientation, physical handicaps, mental handicaps. You know, there's a whole list of things, right? So it's against the law to discriminate. And it's still unresolved that in Toronto, some of the original, there's 11 agnostic, atheist, humanist, free thinker meetings in Toronto now. But at the time when they kicked out two of them, and then a third one started and they kicked that one out too, they've never been included in the book. They've never been invited to have a voice at Intergroup. And so he said, hey, you know, you can't do that. You can have group conscience, but it can't be against the law.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say, you know, no gay meetings. You know, you can't say...
But it's different literature,
well,
isn't it?
Again, Intergroup is just a holding place where
right.
we get to participate in something. And if you sort of believe in the AA structure and traditions, if you're not part of that... You're not part of the larger community. And his position is, hey, you know, my right to AA membership is inalienable. AA didn't give it to me. Intergroup didn't give it to me. And Intergroup neither grants me the right to have a group, nor can it take it away. You know, and you can vote this way or you can vote that way, but I'm taking issue with that. So there's a hearing, and no one's been found of any wrongdoing, but that's what's going on right now.
Well, we have to get towards wrapping up. I don't want to put any pressure. Does Mom have any thoughts? She's been sitting here, my very brilliant mother, who I'm sure has been taking in everything.
I know.
Well, you can, they can't hear you on a, with if you're not on a mic.
Oh, but that's okay.
But we can repeat a question or a thought, and we can we can riff off it.
Joe can be your translator, as if it's another language.
Ask me a specific question.
Do you have any thoughts on our conversation? It's okay if you don't. It's a lot of pressure.
A lot of it I don't understand. I am not part of this fellowship.
Mm-hmm.
And the literature is all foreign to me.
So what she's saying, just because I am repeating, okay. is that, you know, she's unfamiliar with the fellowship.
Yeah.
And
let me ask you this. Does it seem strange that an organization devoted to carrying, you know, the message of sobriety to alcoholics would be irritated or offended in any way by agnostics or atheists?
Not at all. I think it would be enlarged and to the betterment of the fellowship as a whole, mm-hmm. to be as adaptive as possible. And I agree with you that if in all matters, not just your fellowship, one either adapts to change or grows extinct. And we don't need Darwin to tell us that.
It is too bad that the listener can't hear her because that was extremely articulate.
Yeah.
Do you have a photographing?
Okay.
Really?
Okay. Right on. And yeah, I mean, you know, I really have a problem with catastrophic thinking, mm-hmm. and it happens on both sides.
I
right?
have it.
Yeah. We all do, yeah. right? You know, like I like to deny my own when I say something like I'm against catastrophic thinking, right? But because we have, you know, these people that go, well, if we change this or it'll accommodate, it'll fall apart. You know, maybe the magic is in a word somewhere and we take that word out and everyone will get drunk and, you know, that'll be the end of AA. I mean, or if we make this accommodation, what do we do next? So that's catastrophic thinking, right? The slippery slope. And they usually use the word slippery slope.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, you hear, you know, if they don't change the literature, I have been known to say that if at our 100th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're gathered around the same 164 pages, the beginning of the big book that has an article, you know, chapter Two Wives, which is...
That's the one thing I'm not down with.
Yeah, it should be two loved ones, and maybe it should, you know, even be authored by the Al-Anon perspective, people who have suffered through what we've done. We Agnostics isn't by agnostics. It's warning to agnostics.
Not much about being agnostic either.
Yeah. So, you know, like, if we haven't in some way sort of, you know, expanded past that, we're going to be considered like the Amish. We'll be quaint, mm-hmm. Irrelevant, and harmless. But, you know, we won't be like the number one way that people are finding recovery. Like, it's just, I mean, can you picture millennials? I mean, you know, like in Europe, most of them have never been in a church.
Yeah, but I mean, we so have to wrap up. But I would say in this ever more spiritual culture,
yes.
that millennials I know mm-hmm. are deep into the spirituality.
Sure they are. Yeah, but they don't want to drive their dad's old Buick, right? They want to experience that and sort of share that in a, you know, not in a rigid language, but in their own way of, you know, relating to people. Like who would use terms like, I pray to good orderly direction outside of an AA meeting. I mean, that's a way of trying to fit into the mold and express your, you know, uniqueness, right? Mm-hmm. But you wouldn't tell a work associate that. You wouldn't use that in talking to your kids about, you know, worldviews and how they differ. There's a lot that we do to try to, you know, play nice. That just, why can't we just not be offended and just everyone share the experience, and let's not be so crazy about the explanation there. Now we can wrap up on where we started.
Yeah, we got back to explanation. I think it's a good note to end on.
Okay, that was Joe C. on the After Party Pod. Go check him out at RebellionDogsPublishing.com. And thank you for listening. After Party Pod.